Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What issues and agendas led the United States to re-elect President Obama yesterday, and is there any reason to hope a second Obama term will be less gridlocked than the first? With the Senate remaining under Democratic control and the House run by the Republicans, the White House will have a hard row to hoe despite yesterday's significant electoral majority. But the U.S. has important business to do in the immediate future, from figuring out a sustainable balance for spending and revenue to supporting and expanding weaker-than-hoped economic recovery to forging a workable solution to rising entitlement spending. So did yesterday's events suggest any of that will be possible? And will it be a matter of playing chicken on the fiscal cliff and other issues so that one side is forced to duck while the other blasts ahead? Or can we find a middle path that has until now eluded us? Matthew Eshbaz-Soha is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas. Victoria Farrar Myers is Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas at Arlington. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thanks.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so before we get into what will happen, I want to step back and talk a bit about what did happen yesterday, starting with the fact that what looks like a substantial victory, if you look at the Electoral College numbers, gets a lot closer looks a lot less like a strong mandate when you look at the popular vote. What's the significance of that with regard to the mandate the president has moving forward?
Well, I don't think the president has a mandate. I think President Obama will try to claim a mandate, as all presidents have done. But you're right. The president's popular vote is roughly what George W. Bush had in 2004. He also claimed a mandate and promptly got spanked on Social Security reform. So President Obama needs to consider that, and in terms of his strategy for what policies and how he's going to go forward trying to pass those policies.
I think also President Obama needs to consider the fact that when you look at the electoral map and you look at the county by county map, it's very red. So we're still a center right country. And that being the case, there still is going to be questions about how they're going to reach, as you said at the top of the hour, how they're going to reach the balance and what's going to make them reach the balance. And I think that's part of what both sides need to take lessons from last night. I don't think the president can be emboldened by claiming a mandate at all. But I think also the Republicans can't be emboldened at all because they missed a very good opportunity to retake the Senate now twice in 2010 and 2012.
Well, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell had been saying, of course, that his primary concern was getting Obama to have a single term. Now he is saying, following yesterday's results, the president really needs to move to the center. Is there any sense at all that compromise is possible?
I'm an optimist on this. I think with the fiscal cliff, I think there has to be compromise. Our Constitution forces compromise with checks and balances and separation of powers. That's the only way something's going to be done. You can sort of imagine a line, and we have the left and the right in the middle. The president's on the left, the House Republicans on the far right. The compromise in the bargain is going to be somewhere in the middle, probably right of center, because I agree with Victoria, the nation is more conservative than liberal. But there has to be a deal. Everybody expects one. The president effectively promised one in the third debate, and Republicans have to demonstrate that they can actually pass legislation that solves the nation's problems.
I almost hate to raise this the day after, and we're not even finished counting some votes in certain counties in the state of Florida, but 2014 is really the next step, and I think both parties are going to be thinking about this when they are dealing with this issue coming up. How are they going to position themselves for the midterm elections in 2014? In particular, the Republicans are going to have to not box themselves in and look like obstructionists. And I think Democrats also are going to have to keep in mind that they can't push too hard, because certainly they also were chastened last night by the election outcomes. So I think for both parties, I agree with Matt that both parties have an interest in trying to find some common ground. And I guess a little bit more cynical in a sense that I think it's re-election imperative, and the midterm elections is really what we're going to see. We have a president who wants to leave a legacy, and we got two political parties that are already starting to worry about midterm elections.
So what would compromise look like? In other words, would the president be willing to let go of some tax hikes for the wealthy if he were promised in return other benefits that he wanted to see from Republicans?
You know, it's interesting to if you start parsing out the plans. I mean, if you look at the Ryan plan, which Romney was sort of embracing, and then you look at the bipartisan Erskine Bowles, the Bowles Commission, I think a lot of folks are looking to the commission report at today, at least, and looking at the pieces and parts of which that they can draw conclusions with. I think a number of Republicans and Democrats have indicated that they're willing to compromise around that because it's sort of a third party sort of outside the two-party chamber compromise. But I think the problem, though, with either one of the positions is that they're going to risk losing their base. And I think each one is going to, whatever they give up, are risking making their base unhappy.
And that's why I think that if we're going to have a grand bargain, a serious compromise, a lot of this is going to have to be negotiated behind closed doors, not unlike the 1983 deal between Ronald Reagan and the House Democrats to save Social Security. I think we need something like that. The idea is to provide political cover to all involved so that can't be a political issue in the 2014 midterm elections and beyond. Whether that happens or not, I think that's the road. Whether that happens or not, given the polarized nature of our political system, giving the strong reelection incentive of members of the House of Representatives, I think that's an open question. But that's what I would expect to see happen if we have a significant deal on this issue.
So is it your sense that behind closed doors, maybe members of Congress are more willing to work together, but they have to really save face when it comes to going back to their bases? It almost sounds like you're describing two countries that are at war, and you put their diplomats together in a closed room and they say, look, we know the deal.
I think so. I mean, I think that there could be a situation where Speaker Boehner, President Obama, they can say things that appeal to their base and keep them happy. But the overall deal would be one that would really balance both sides on this budget negotiation.
And I agree wholeheartedly with what Matt just said, because I think one of the things that they can count on is that the American public doesn't spend a lot of time in the details of some of these large pieces of legislation. And so the rhetoric that they use to describe what it is they're doing will help them package it for both their strong bases. And I think by doing that, they can really help themselves. I do agree, though, that in order for a grand bargain to happen, behind the scenes is going to be where things are going to have to happen. I think that's where they're really going to have to create a compromise in terms of where they're going to give and where they're not, and then how are they going to package it so that both of them are on the same types of talking points, so that neither one sort of violates the behind the scenes door sort of compromise.
It seems like for years and years we've been talking about whether this would be the year that the Latino vote really made a difference. And it seems like as much as any year in the past, 2012 has been that election. Talk about the appeal of the DNC, of the Democratic Party, to Latinos now, and whether or not there is any risk that they will take that support for granted moving into the future rather than serving that new constituency.
Well, there's always a risk, and I don't think the Democratic Party should be too confident in their hold on the Latino vote. I think it's strong and it's there. Republicans have missed multiple opportunities. I think President George W. Bush tried to reach out to that voting bloc. Senator McCain, before he became candidate, McCain had as well on the issue of immigration. So I think the Democratic Party needs to move forward. I think that you could lose some of the Latino vote, unmobilize them, if you will, if you don't act on immigration in the next year or so. The president was able to say, hey, I couldn't get it done in my first term. But if he doesn't do it in the second term, I think there's a real risk to the Democratic Party.
I think also, too, this has been the conundrum for the Republican Party, because on social issues, on religious issues and other issues, it would appear as if the Latino and Hispanic, if we are to be, I always hate to treat them as a monolithic group,
sure,
but if we were able to treat them as such, you would think that Republicans would be able to reach out to that community much more than they have been able to do so. So I do agree with Matt that this probably, what we saw happen last night, was more issue-driven in a sense that immigration was a major issue to mobilize this voting bloc. But again, I think both parties at their peril risk taking this voting bloc for granted, and frankly, to even think of it as a bloc, because I think they, you know, Cubans versus Latinos versus Hispanics versus Mexicans. We have to be very careful as political analysts to not sort of just overarchingly say this is a monolithic group, just like women are not monolithic groups, just like, you know, other groups are not. And we tend to treat it such in larger aggregate data. But I think, you know, when it comes to on the ground, how you win their vote, how you actually ask them to come out and vote next time for your political party, they're going to be looking at what are you delivering and what have you actually been able to realize.
Well, I was somewhat surprised by the turnout, given that it seemed as if neither presidential candidate spent a lot of time talking about immigration or about, and I'm using the air quotes here, Latino issues, except when they were in front of groups that were largely made up of that population.
Well, I don't think either candidate could excel on that particular issue. The president did not achieve immigration reform, so you don't want to advertise that. Mitt Romney had taken a variety of positions as it related to immigration. So I think it's a tricky issue. Republicans know that. That's why, you know, Rick Perry really got hammered on the issue in the Republican primary. Mitt Romney had to take a conservative position and then move to the center. But I think for both political parties, even if we look at it a re-election incentive, maybe not in the short term for Republicans, but over the long term, if they want to be able to appeal to the Latino voting bloc, and again, not monolithic, but certainly on the issue of immigration, they have to be willing to address that issue, sort of take it off the table so that they can perhaps appeal to other issues that the Latino voters are concerned with.
It's interesting that we use this term immigration reform, because that almost seems to suggest that we know what that looks like. And mm-hmm. and I wonder if part of the problem is that everyone is aware that there is a problem with the volume of undocumented people we have in this country for a variety of different reasons. People don't necessarily agree on why they are a problem, and then they don't know what you do about it in the meantime.
Well, I think they're, you know, we're a land of immigrants. We're all immigrants of some sort from someplace. And so I think that's always a touchy issue in terms of what do we mean by the other? And defining the other is always difficult in politics, because when you do that, you suddenly set up opposition groups. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really a key for going back to what Matt just articulated about the delicate balance that both parties have to play with this particular issue. I think also, you know, with the Republicans, they've been very unwilling in some ways to discuss sort of the idea of amnesty, or discuss, you know, sort of what do we do with the people that are already here? And they sort of, at least we heard very little being said in this campaign by congressional folks all the way up the ballot. On the Democratic side, I think, you know, they did benefit by the executive order that the president gave, and it just sort of sat out there as, see, we did try to do something. So I think one of the things going forward, again, with the Latino vote and with the Hispanic vote is really understanding how we define immigration. Do we mean quotas? Do we mean amnesty? Or are we going to go as far as to talk about a pathway to citizenship? Now, certainly, if you go way back, you can look at McCain and McCain's attempt in the Senate to try to come up with a bargain where there was a pathway to citizenship, where there was some bipartisan support for that. And there is that sort of that model that's still out there that I think potentially now that, you know, the dust is sort of settling and they've seen sort of the numbers and people know that this is going to be an issue that's going to be prominent for this group going forward, I think there is at least a model that they could borrow from.
Victoria Farrar Myers is professor of political science at the University of Texas at Arlington, and Matthew Eshba Soha, my second guest, is associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. We are talking this hour about post-election perspective and what's going to happen going forward. We would love to have your input on this. Perhaps you'd like to ask a question. You can do that at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Victoria Farrar Myers, who is professor of political science at the University of Texas at Arlington, and Matthew Eshbasoha, associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now where we have Brett on the line in Louisville. Hey, Brett.
Hey, Chris. I was just wondering your opinion or your guest opinions on if anyone has, as far as immigration is concerned, if anybody's thought about doing what Ronald Reagan did, which was grant amnesty and then implement the E-Verify system to all employers. I thought that would be a kind of a quick and clean way to rectify the issue. I'd love to hear your opinion.
Thanks for calling. Is that on the table, seriously, anywhere?
Not for Republicans. I mean, amnesty is a loaded word, and it's something that even Democrats who might favor something like that have a difficult time using that particular word. So I think something like that, a compromise or something fashionable like that. But it is interesting that Republicans, I mean, the caller is right that Ronald Reagan signed a piece of legislation that did effectively that, but that's part of the ammunition for why they don't want to see that sort of amnesty. And I think a deal will have to craft that path to citizenship in a less obvious way than so-called amnesty.
I would agree with that. I would definitely say that language, that rhetorical language of pathway to citizenship is really the key words in 2012 and not amnesty. I don't see us going back to Ronald Reagan. And it was a different time and a different way in which they were discussing these issues. I think also, though, your caller asked about the E-Verify. And I think E-Verify certainly is an easier sell to most folks. I think, you know, there's been some bipartisan groups who've come out – groups of legislatures who have come out that have agreed on that. The states have seemed very interested in utilizing that. Certainly, there's always a civil rights, civil liberties issues about sharing of information. But I think that might be an area, certainly, of enforcement that would be easier for them to sell.
There is some early exit polling data that describes the demographics of people who voted, but of course that has to be taken with a grain of salt, at least initially. But I wonder, Victoria, if you can characterize the pundits overblow the Republican Party's woman problem in terms of the response and the voters?
I don't think they overblown the women's problem. I think, you know, in lots of ways, there was a woman's problem. There was two particular congressional races that you had two individuals running on the Republican ballot who made not so great comments that I think drove a lot of the dialogue and drove a lot of the dialogue that the national candidates then had to deal with. I think they created a lot of problems for the national ticket, the Romney ticket, because they had to deal with these sort of off stories. Certainly, it's interesting to see, though, that the gender gap is alive and well. It's interesting, to see that women did break toward the Democratic Party once again. And I think that's a really interesting phenomenon. However, you know, before the whole hurricane happened, there was a real question by a lot of women voters in the polls leading up to when the hurricane happened by women voters about the economy being the number one. So it was interesting. I was really actually kind of interested in why that sort of happened. And was it really just the gaffes that we saw the amount of national media that was given to those two particular individuals.
And we should say, if you're talking about Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch,
yes,
they both lost.
They both lost. And I think, you know, that's why I raised those only in the sense that they crowded out the news. Mm-hmm. The message that Romney wanted to really deliver was crowded out by two individuals making two comments. And I think that really hogged the national spotlight in a lot of ways that may have resonated in this world of social media. It had a cacophony of voices. And I think that really resonated with a lot of women. But again, I was really sort of surprised in a sense that we did not see the economic issues really play out as much as they were playing out, at least leading into all the polls leading up to the last week of the campaign.
Well, even among the economy, I think that, you know, still a fairly top issue. for a lot of different voting blocks. I think that what is interesting and unusual from other elections where we would see an unemployment rate around 8% is that voters were willing to give Barack Obama still the benefit of the doubt. We usually don't see that. But I think voters, even though the economy was strongest for Romney, we saw this in the various debates, he kept coming back to the economy. This was Obama's weakest issue. He still was able to keep some Democratic support because I think they still believe that he didn't cause the economic recession. And when push came to shove, they were more willing to stick with his vision for the economy than what Governor Romney had offered.
Well, and speaking to add to what Matt just said, and one of the exit polls that came out really quickly last night in the exit polls was that very, very designation where people said, you know, we are willing, we still blame George W. Bush for what happened. We're still blaming that fiscal crisis. We're still willing to give him more time. That there does take more time. So it's interesting that argument that Obama had been making that really didn't resonate, hadn't been resonating at all, resonated in the exit polls.
So Maine and Maryland yesterday approved same-sex marriage by popular vote, which makes them different from the other states that have had same-sex laws allowed based on legislative votes or court orders. There are six other states plus the District of Columbia now. Is there a sort of critical mass of states needed in order for the Supreme Court to take this on and look at federal recognition of same-sex marriage?
Well, I think the environment is such that this is an issue that the Supreme Court has to address. We have states that support it. We have states that oppose it. But clearly, that's the role that the Supreme Court has to play. The Congress has passed the Defense of Marriage Act and signed by President Clinton years ago. But I think there are a lot of legal concerns about recognition of gay marriage across other states. And this is the role of the Supreme Court to come together and issue a national ruling so that states and same-sex couples understand the law and what their rights and responsibilities are.
I think you definitely – I agree with Matt in a sense that you definitely did see the Supreme Court sort of signal to many of the groups that they needed to see this type of support happening, that it a popular support, not just not a state legislature or not a referendum, but actually seeing this type of behavior happen. And I agree with him in a sense that this is exactly the time when the case is more ripe for the Supreme Court to take out head on. Because again, whenever you have a differentiation in our federalist system where we have federalism, where a national law and a state laws are in contradiction, this is really when the Supreme Court is apt to step in. And I think this court has shown a proclivity to be able to step into very controversial issues much quicker than other courts have.
And turnover on the Supreme Court over the next 4 years, of course, there's always the calculation for the opposing party's justices. Do I hang on for four more years or is it possible that we'll have, a subsequent term by someone of the same party? What do you imagine might happen?
Well, strategically, I mean, I think if Justice Ginsburg was looking to retire, I think this is the time for her to do so. If she was thinking going another 4 years, it's risky. But certainly I would suspect that it's in her calculation that if she was considering retirement, Barack Obama wins. She knows her replacement is going to be more like her. This helps maintain and further her legacy. And so I think if we're going to see turnover, it'd be an individual such as Justice Ginsburg.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Chris. I guess I have to disagree with the opening characterization that yesterday's results prove that the United States is a center-right country now. The only way you see a majority of red states is if you realize that those are the states where nobody lives. Most of the population is in California, New York, Illinois, and with the exception of Texas and perhaps Florida, where the results aren't fully complete yet, those states that I just named went to the left. You could easily just say this is a primarily center-left country. With that in mind, what do you think about the viability of President Obama focusing in 2 years on taking back the Congress and using that as kind of a bully pulpit to get congressmen to bend to his will? In other words, if congressmen don't compromise at best, and more likely and preferably just bend completely to President Obama's will, what if he threatens to parachute squads of organizers into recalcitrant congressmen's districts and really whip up opposition to their candidacy, to their election chances, re-election chances?
Well, let's get some perspective on that. Thanks for your call, Ed.
Well, I'll take the second part of that. And, you know, there's this perception that the president can use the bully pulpit, that the president can motivate supporters to turn out members of Congress in terms of having them defeated. But presidents aren't very good at that. Presidents always lose seats at midterm. Mm-hmm. Presidents always lose popular support by the time we get to midterm election. We saw what happened to Obama in 2010. It happened to Bill Clinton in 1994. We've had some unusual situations with 98 in 2002, but it's unlikely that President Obama is going to be able to go into Republican districts and appeal to Republican voters who dominate those districts and convince them to elect a Democrat. That's just not going to happen.
I would concur with the fact that on the second part of the question, that the it's not in the interest. We saw the president already not having a proclivity to, and in fact, his own party is taking him to task today for not doing more to help help Congress and help the take back the House, you know, take back the House and take back the, and retain the Senate. So I think, you know, there's been a lot of sort of consternation on the Democratic side about the fact that he has been unwilling to go into those congressional districts. Now, as far as the first part of the question that the caller sort of took umbrage with, which is my assertion earlier. And I think if you look at the larger, and I'm not talking about the electoral map in terms of state by state, I'm talking about the county by county map. If you look at the county by county map, the county by county map is more red than blue. And so what my suggestion was is that we need to, both parties need to be chastened to think about how they are going to approach the election from a bottom up. And so for next time, you know, for 20, whether we're talking midterms election or the next presidential election, I think both parties need to be really cognizant of who's where and also be cognizant of the fact that we still do have a lot of red in those counties. Now, yes, your caller is correct. In the urban centers, you certainly do have that. In exurbs, you certainly do see more a Democratic. And certainly in Virginia, for example, Obama winning Fairfax by so much let Virginia obviously go to his column. But certainly the rest of the state looked really red. So I think that's one of the things that we have to sort of come to terms with, is that our country really is very balanced in terms of partisanship, ideology. And I think that's something that both of the parties are going to have to think about when they're thinking about who they're going to field in 2014 and in 2016.
So arguably, California sort of blazed the trail sideways a few years ago with medical marijuana, and I'm just regretting using the word blazed. now we have two states, Washington State and Colorado, allowing for recreational use of marijuana, which is a very different thing entirely, even if the California laws are sort of loosely enforced with regard to who is qualified. What do you think other states are watching for with regard to how well this works, and how does all this jive with the federal laws that don't allow for the use of recreational marijuana?
Well, it's in violation of the federal law. So if the FBI, the DEA want to enforce federal law, that just because you're protected under state law, the Supreme Court ruled on this a few years ago. I think that is probably what states are looking forward to. How is the federal government going to be able to address this? Can we get a national solution to this particular issue? Because it's not just medicinal marijuana in several states, also last night, but legalization or decriminalization in some respects. This is becoming more of a popular issue, but resolving the conflict between states and the federal government being supreme, is vital to these laws being sustainable over the long term.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Alan in Fort Worth. Hi, Alan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to ask your panel about, in light of the referendum results in Puerto Rico, what we could expect to see as far as Congress taking action in making Puerto Rico a state.
This has come up several times. I don't foresee Congress making Puerto Rico a state. I certainly recognize that I'm not an expert on Puerto Rico statehood, but I just don't see it. I just don't see it happening.
I would agree too. I mean, even discussions of advancing tax base or expanding tax base, I think there's really not a thunderous movement abreast. I think there's more pressing issues, as we've talked about, in terms of the fiscal cliff, deficit and debt, that are in line before for this issue. And certainly this issue has been on the agenda for, been sort of bubbling on the agenda for many, many years. And again, unlike like Matt, I am not an expert in this area, although, and I know it's a very heartfelt by those that are involved in this. I just don't see that at this point in time it makes the governing agenda.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Tanya in Dallas. Hi, Tanya.
Hi. My question, I know you all spoke about immigration and the Latino vote changing. What I was wondering, well, let me begin. I'm an African-American woman, and I believe in the Republican ideas, but I found that I voted for Obama, and more so to just vote against Romney. Do you think that the Republican Party is going to be able to, if they just move towards trying to engage the Latino population, if they'll be able to do it, or will they need to purge their party of the Tea Party and the extreme views that they have? That's why I voted against the Republicans.
Well, that's tricky for Republicans. And we talk about amnesty. We talk about immigration reform. The Tea Party faction in the Republican Party is not going to support any kind of immigration reform, the best I can tell. So this speaks to the larger polarization, the extreme views of the Tea Party pressuring Republicans. George W. Bush, when president, put forth a relatively moderate immigration reform policy, and it failed because of these similar Tea Party influences, even though the Tea Party came about later. So I think that this is the real challenge for Republicans. Who are they representing? If they're representing the Tea Party, it becomes very difficult to support comprehensive immigration reform that includes a lot of the provisions that Democrats might like, something like the DREAM Act. But on the other side, failure to act means that they are at risk of losing the potential to build a reliable Latino voting bloc for future elections.
I think also, too, we still have a lot of those Tea Party folks who won in the 2010 midterm elections who are still sitting in Congress who have to contend. We have to contend with them. And the National Republican Party is going to have to contend with them in dealing with a lot of the issues that Matt was pointing out. I think also, you know, here at home, we certainly heard Senator Cruz talk a little bit about Senator-elect Cruz, mm-hmm. I should say, talk a little bit about the fact that he was feeling he would be open to compromise, but he said, it only if and only if they dealt with issues that were near and dear to the values of the Tea Party and the folks that put him there. So I think that's a really important point that is telling about the future actions.
Victoria Farrar Myers is here along with Matthew Eshba-Soha. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Matthew Eshba-Soha, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas, and Victoria Farrar Myers, Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas at Arlington. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. To what extent will the provisions of the Affordable Care Act be rendered essentially immutable by the end of a second Obama term?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that I expect House Republicans to vote to repeal it again. This is something that they can give to their constituents. And there's a lot of complication in the implementation of the law. But I think the main provisions have been upheld by the Supreme Court. I suspect Congress could move to affect funding in a variety of ways. But this is something that we're going to watch as it goes forward. I think the main provisions will continue. And I have this sneaking suspicion that people are actually going to like a lot of these provisions, and it might actually become more popular as the law is implemented and people see the benefits from it.
I think, though, it does create some issues in implementation for the states? Because a lot of states, I think, were waiting to deal with the implementation issue to see how this election turned out. And now it's turned out in a way that they are now going to have to scramble to bring up to speed their plans for implementation by January. So I think you're going to see a lot of states really behind the eight ball in terms of trying to get themselves up and running and to deal with some of the provisions of the act. So I think on the state level, it's going to be difficult. I think certainly here in Texas, you know, the expansion of Medicare is obviously going to continue going to be an issue. We certainly have the federalism issue. Given the way the Supreme Court wrote their decision, Chief Justice Roberts writing the decision, he certainly opened the door to allow states to sort of ignore that portion of it and certainly allowed for Congress not only to deal with it, but to deal with it as the taxing power, which certainly would allow for some maneuvering, certainly by the House, definitely by the House. Obviously, the Democrats holding on to the Senate was key to that, making sure that the health care bill continued.
Was there comparable broad opposition to Medicare when it was enacted? Were people concerned about a government takeover of health care for the elderly?
Absolutely. When Medicare was first introduced, you know, Medicare, Social Security, certainly, you know, unemployment insurance, all of these were introduced as stopgap measures. In fact, they were the rhetorical speech that was used around these where they were stopgap measures to get us through an economically difficult time. The perception was that they would not continue. And I think this, you know, Medicare itself has always been problematic. There's been a series of reforms, obviously, throughout our history. Presidents have dealt with different aspects of it. So I think, you know, this issue is not going to go away. Entitlement reform itself, given the fiscal cliff that we're under, entitlement as what part of the entitlement pie, I think, is really going to have to be dealt with, because entitlement reform is going to be the key to driving down the percentage of GDP that we're seeing in our debt right now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Robert in Dallas. Hello, Robert.
Hi, how are you guys?
Very well, thanks.
Good. My kind of question or comment for your guest today is about term limits, and you know, with President Obama now being reelected, he is the third president in a row to be elected for two terms for a total of 8 years. I'm wondering if this might be kind of evidence that the world we live in this most recent past is too complicated to really support a four-year term, and you know, looking at maybe longer term limits in the future.
Well, you know, establishing term limits, changing the term limit for the president has to be done through constitutional amendment. Jimmy Carter argued that we should amend the Constitution to give the president 1 6-year term so that the president can focus on policy and trying to, you know, help compromise and solve major policy problems without the specter of reelection. I think that's highly unlikely. I think perhaps what it suggests is that, you know, the challengers that have been brought by the opposing party, that the campaigns have done a really good job of disqualifying them, disqualifying Kerry in 2004, Romney in 2012, and Bob Dole in 1996. It suggests that incumbent presidents have a good deal of power, perhaps not to change congressional elections, but to really secure their own reelection, much as members of Congress have a strong incumbency advantage as well.
Well, certainly if you look back in all the way back to the Founding Fathers, the Founding Fathers perceived that the presidency would have this longer-term vision, and thus there was no term limits placed on the president other than a 4-year term continued in good behavior. And it wasn't until the 22nd Amendment when we had the two terms of no more than 10-year limitation after FDR's, you know, run at and lack of completion, obviously, because of his untimely death, with Truman having to fill out his fourth term. But I think, you know, the caller raises an interesting point, because if the president is supposed to have a long-term vision like the Founding Fathers had desired them to do, and a lot of these issues we're talking about are not issues that are solved overnight. And I think, you know, while I do agree with Matt that, you know, certainly the challengers that have been put up have been easier, somewhat easier, I would suggests somewhat easier in a sense. Certainly the economy this time around made it a little bit more, much closer probably than the Democrats would have liked. But I think, you know, certainly term limits themselves, changing the structure of what originally was planned for the presidency, really has had a significant impact in what presidents can accomplish.
Yeah, and keep in mind that the framers didn't want term limits because they believed that the incentive for good behavior of incumbent presidents was that prospect of reelection. And what we've seen, oddly, I don't want to overgeneralize, but all of the last two-term presidents have been afflicted with a fairly serious scandal in their second term with Watergate, Iran-Contra, Monica Lewinsky, the Scooter Libby Valerie Plame situation with the Bush administration. So I don't want to, make any definitive predictions, but the past suggests that Barack Obama is up for an interesting
a major
political
scandal.
Yes.
Do you think that we are any closer to truly challenging the Electoral College system? Or, this time it turns out that the Electoral College and the popular vote were at least reached the same conclusion. But boy, if you look at the margins, they're so very different.
Well, I think it gets to the agenda issue that Victoria brought up earlier about Puerto Rico. I think you could get some support for this. Obviously, the battleground states, the representatives there are reluctant to do that. Even if you were to get two-thirds support, I don't think there's a pressing enough. There's no momentum, no likelihood that it's going to be on the agenda to muster the two-thirds support necessary to amend the Constitution and get rid of the Electoral College. So I just don't think it's going to make the agenda this time around.
And I would agree with that. And I would add one point in the fact that in the 2012, in this election in 2012, we saw places like New Hampshire with four Electoral College votes matter, which, when you think of Electoral College and why people say to get rid of it, it's the winner-take-all system and the suggestion that certainly candidates ignore anything but the big states with the big Electoral College prizes. And certainly the battleground states, those nine or eight that we got down to, and really were outside those big, big states. And so I think it basically took a little bit of the wind out of the sails of those folks that really wanted, to get rid of the Electoral College because, their whole argument is big states get all the attention. Well, that really didn't happen. It was battleground states that were smaller, and who would have thought we were going to be even thinking about New Hampshire and whether or not New Hampshire was going to play in some mathematical model last night.
I don't know whether you saw the text or you watched the speeches live. Was there anything in Mr. Romney's concession speech or Mr. Obama's acceptance speech that or victory speech that struck you as particularly noteworthy?
They both sounded like fairly typical.
It's what
concession
you do.
And mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what you do. So we're not looking, for they were perfectly fine speeches. There was nothing inflammatory or, sour grapes on the part of Governor Romney. It's a speech that is made. There's rhetoric, but now business has to be done. And, business isn't done with speeches and rhetoric. It's in this case with the fiscal cliff, it's going to be behind closed doors, cutting very difficult political deals.
Though I would say, though, that was one thing that was interesting to me. While I agree that they were sort of the typical sort of speeches, and certainly Mitt Romney's was very much the typical conciliatory speech and get me out of here sort of thing.
But makes sense.
Which
I'm sure
totally
the guy's exhausted and he just wants to go home.
You just laid your heart and soul out and it's done. You go home and you have to figure out what you do next. But I think, it was interesting to watch President Obama sort of returned to the rhetoric that he had in his acceptance speech originally in his first term, where he was trying to say, I'm president of everyone. I'm going to try to be that uniter that I wasn't able to do before, that I'm going to try to be an educator in chief, which I know that I didn't do before. So I think that was interesting to see is while he was accepting, he was also, I think, admitting as much as we've seen this president admit the certain aspects that he has not probably fully taken advantage of in his presidency. And so that to me kind of struck me a little bit as a little different than normally what you would see in acceptance speech other than what I've seen in the current past.
What sort of future do you anticipate for Paul Ryan?
Well, there's speculation 2016 running for president. I think he has, some of the attributes that we look forward to, but I think it comes down to the fiscal cliff. I mean, what role is he going to play in these budget negotiations? Is he going to be a leader of his party? Is he going to be a leader of the Tea Party? What is his role? And I think that if he's too responsive to Tea Party interests on this particular issue, we've seen with Mitt Romney as he moved from the Republican Party to the general election, moving from the right to the center, it's very difficult to run for the House of Representatives when your core constituency is the Tea Party. It might help him win the Republican primary, but then he has a, then he would have a lot of legwork to appeal to a fairly broad middle in the United States.
What's interesting, though, I think about Ryan in particular, though, is once he was named vice president, he sort of disappeared off the national stage. In one sense, he gave sort of an intellectual kind of core to Romney. He was able to use at least the budget plan, regardless of the sort of hits it took throughout the campaign. But it gave an intellectual core. And I think he didn't really do much damage to himself in terms of he was a good player. He was a good running mate. He played well on the national stage. He does have some name recognition. And I think he could use that quite well when he returns back to the House. But again, I think Matt's absolutely correct. He's got to be very careful of how he plays this. Does he want to, if he does have plans for greater steps forward, then I think he really is going to have to figure out how to be a uniter, not a divider.
I almost hate that we're skating here closer to 2016 with every question, but I'm curious about the Chris Christie issue and the embrace of President Obama's assistance through FEMA and through other federal aid programs. I mean, can we assume that that was entirely non-political on the part of Christie, or does he, in the back of his mind, have this sense that he would like to appeal to a broad swath of the American public, which he did not do, I have to say, in the convention? It felt very much like a very partisan speech.
Well, you know, we can always speculate about presidential aspirations and think about the motivation behind that. I think Governor Christie was being a governor, and governors like help from well-run federal agencies in times of disaster. I mean, he's an individual who I think this is why people like him. He says things how they are. He said that Romney was going to beat Obama badly in the first debate, and he was right.
When everybody was kind of hedging their bets.
Exactly. They were trying to lower expectations, and Christie came out and said, no question here, it's going to be a blowout. So I think that's what people like about Chris Christie. You see what you get. Whether he's looking forward to the presidency in 2016, whether he made that comment to help President Obama and thus benefit Chris Christie's chances of running for president in 2016. I don't want to speculate, but 2016 is 4 years away.
Do you want to speculate, Victoria?
Well, I just think that it's interesting that he chose the moment at which he did make those comments, because all the internal polls going in the Romney campaign, which is starting to slowly leak out, the margins were a lot larger than some of the national polls had seen in terms of how they were doing. Also, there was very much a recognition that the ground game, they were losing badly in the ground game to the Obama campaign. So I think it's interesting that he took that time, that moment to make that statement. One, it gives him name recognition in the national realm. It puts him right smack dab in the presidential discussion, at least. I mean, obviously, we're talking about him today. But I think also, there's a governor's race between now and then, and he needs to win re-election. And you win re-elections by bringing home the help that is necessary to your state. And I agree with Matt that he does like to shoot it from the hip. And I think a lot of people in the country feel like they want more honesty. They want people who are going to be able to do that, even if they're telling them things that they don't necessarily want to hear.
Victoria Farrar Myers is professor of political science at the University of Texas at Arlington. Matthew Eshba-Soha is associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. It's been wonderful to have both of you in. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can find out about upcoming programs and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.